Are you coming to the tree where they strung up a man? They say murder three. Strange things that happen here. No stranger would it be if we met at midnight in the hanging tree?
And welcome to the show. I'm your host, Chris James. With us tonight is Chris Holm from San Antonio. Chris is an independent comic artist and cultural critic. He started a paranormal and hot topic podcast, Conspire a Theory, in the last year. Some of his guests have included Jeff Crypto Hulk Stewart, who has been on Strange Things, and paranormal detective Greg Lawson. His podcast is a conversational format, peppered with dark humor and common sense. He frequents his local MUFON chapter, and he's a part of a local UFO discussion group. His interests are primarily cryptids and abduction phenomena. I met Chris in Edinburgh at the Out of This World UFO conference, and seeing as we shared a name and an interest in podcasting, we thought we'd go ahead and give it a try and see what we can do here. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Chris James, how's it going? I feel like I'm talking to myself, isn't it?
There's also another Chris James who lives up in Virginia that I converse with once in a while. Feels kind of strange to be talking to people with your own name.
Yeah, don't we know it? Yeah, when I first, let me just say to the audience, it's amazing how I came across the show, Strange Things. It was almost like a fluke. I would even go so far as to say it was a synchronicity type of thing. I was going to, me and several friends from the one of the UFO discussion groups that I'm a part of, we were all going to plan to go to Edinburgh together for their annual festival. And unfortunately, my friends couldn't make it. And then while I'm looking at the event page, someone posted a podcast talking about the Edinburgh incident. And I was like, I had no idea there was an Edinburgh incident. I need to check this out. And then next thing you know, I'm listening to an episode of Chris James, Strange Things, with was it Noe Torres?
Yes, sir.
I believe was the show. Yeah, and he was talking about this fascinating incident that happened in Edinburgh. And I'm like, this is so cool. I'm going to have to talk to this guy if I ever run into him. So and it just so happened that you just happened to be one of the
vendors.
Vendors, yeah, one of the vendors at the event. And I was, you know, I like waited at your table for like maybe like an hour. You know, I chit chat with Travis Walton every now and then. And I was just waiting for you to get back from I believe you were probably in a panel or something. Nope. And I said, you know, I just got to talk to this guy, you know, because I listened to the show. I loved it. And I wanted to see what else you had to offer. And next thing you know, we're like talking for like almost 2 hours.
I wasn't on the stage that night. I was just in the room listening to everybody else talk. That's where I was.
Yeah, that was just wild. And I totally got a kick out of us talking. And I said, you know, we need to get together sometime, record a show. And here we are.
Indeed. Well, just to let the listeners know, tonight's show is going to be somewhat different because it will be available not just at Strange Things, but also at your podcast, Conspire a Theory.
Mm-hmm.
How do people find your podcast?
Well, I just in any podcatching app, just look for Conspire a Theory, and you should be able to find it. I'm on the Podomatic Network. That's where they cover my hosting. And you should be able to find it on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. There's a new, let's see, there's a Patreon for it. There's a lot of, I'm trying to cover as many bases as I can. And on Twitter, you just find my personal account, which is PsychoChris. And you go to, and there you can find me. That's pretty much my personal Twitter. And I post show notes from there. I'm also on Tumblr. You can find it there. Just search for Conspire Theory and you'll be able to find one of my various posts on the topic. I'm also on Instagram under Conspire Theory. That's probably the best place to find it because I will be posting, you know, regular updates and whenever a new episode drops, I post stuff on there. And on Facebook, it's easy to find on Facebook, just Conspire Theory, and you'll find it everywhere you look for me. Just look for the cute little cartoon fox, and you'll know you're heading in the right direction.
Did you draw the fox yourself?
Yeah, I did. I did. Before I got into podcasting, I was an independent comic artist, as you had stated. I released several of my own comic books. I had done comic book work for small press, for small independent magazines, and for even been contracted by video game companies, independent video game companies as well, to do contract work for them as well. So I've pretty much been all over the place.
Huh. The music that I play at the beginning of the show, I can't even really tell you the name of the song. I believe it's called Strange Things, but I didn't pick it. Arturo Castro, the guy that owns the studio where I used to broadcast out of, found it on the public domain music at iTunes.
Hmm.
The name Strange Things had actually come from a song by Marlon Williams from New Zealand. And it's a very ghostly kind of song. This guy sees strange things around him. I really liked the song, and I actually wrote to Marlon and tried to get the copyright to the song. Fortunately, mm-hmm. I didn't, because when you go to YouTube, which I have my podcasts on YouTube, anytime mm-hmm. you play music, any music, they will ding you on it, and they'll want a written confirmation in triplicate that's been notarized saying that you have the rights to use that song. Micah Hanks does his own recordings. He's a musician as well as a podcaster. And he has all kinds of grief from the folks at YouTube because they want him to prove that he has the copyrights to that song, even though he wrote the thing and performed it himself. Just a little something to keep in mind if you ever decide you want to put your show on YouTube. They can be a little stringent.
Yeah, I have a audio segment that I played that intros my podcast as well, and it is from a young DJ, and I got her permission to do it. You know, of course, it was through an email,
mm-hmm.
but she gave me the okay to, you know, yeah, go ahead and use my stuff. And I'm like, great, thank you. And so far, I haven't had any troubles from anyone or anything about it. But then again, I'm not posting my stuff on YouTube yet. I'm sure I will. And I've heard of so many issues and stuff through YouTube that I have friends who are regular YouTube contributors and content creators. And I'm like, how do you people do it?
Mm-hmm.
Anytime YouTube, every now and then, they'll go through these, I think it was, because they handle so much monetization,
mm-hmm.
they like, whenever they change up their rules or do anything different, it's like all of a sudden the world is ending for several people because they all have so much money tied up into YouTube that is almost their primary source of income, that they make a living making YouTube content. And a lot of it is fan-driven content like movie reviews, video game streaming. You know, it's other people, it's other companies' content, but they're putting their own spin on it and doing their own presentation. And because, you know, again, the second YouTube decides, well, we're going to reshuffle our monetizing thing, it's like, oh no, that affects their whole income and sends their entire world, you know, upside down. So, yeah, I can understand being completely cautious about stuff like that.
Yeah, it's a work in progress is about the best way to call it. There's a guy, I don't know if you follow him, called Ann Amelie. He just got dinged real bad by the company he was posting through, and they said that he was doing, I think, bad things or something, but I've listened to everything the guy has to say, and I can't find anything wrong with any of his content, but, the people making the decisions are hard to deal with sometimes.
Yeah, I've heard of that incident as well, where what they call it is they hide it under, you're violating community standards.
Something like that.
They're the ones that decide what the community standards are. Mm-hmm. And I've seen several incidents where someone will post some content and, you know, but because they're the, I guess I should say they're, you know, I guess, I'm trying to think of how to word this. They're on the right. They follow the correct. They're politically correct or something. And mm-hmm. if anyone like posts something similar and it's like a bit critical or I don't want to say, you know, it's not wrong or bad. It's just they just have a difference of opinion or they're coming from a different perspective. And it's like, no, that's wrong. Think, how dare you? And then it gets shut down under the guise of violating community standards. So that's, as an artist on principle, I completely, that infuriates me.
Mm-hmm.
Ever as, you know, as the company owner of, you know, as a company, YouTube, you know, again, it's their show, their roof, their rules.
Yes.
So I completely understand that, which is why, you know, like myself and you, whenever we put our stuff out there, you know, we're doing it. We don't have all our eggs in one basket.
I tried to get Strange Things is on TuneIn. It's on Stitcher. It's on Podomatic, YouTube, and a few other places that I had no idea that it was even at. Every once in a while, somebody will say, oh, yeah, I was listening to your show on such and such. And it's like, I didn't know I was available there, but thank you very much.
Yeah, the great thing about most podcatching programs is you really don't need to be dedicated on a specific app or anything. Then all you can do is just take the RSS feed and just plug it into your app and then subscribe it. Because I subscribe to your show through Player FM.
Huh.
It just has a little import. I import the RSS feed into there and then just, you know, listen to your show as if I was subscribing off of any other service.
Huh.
It should still count as downloads and plays from your player.
Mm-hmm.
The let's see. Oftentimes I'll go to other podcasts and I'll ask specifically, like, hey, can I get your guys' RSS feed? You know, and sometimes they don't know what I'm talking about.
I have a good idea what it is, but I couldn't I couldn't put it into words. I just know that it's a address on the computer.
Yeah. I mean, on our profiles, luckily for us, on our Podomatic profiles, they have a little slip on there like, this is the RSS feed. Mm-hmm. You know, just cut and paste this code and it'll do it. It does all the work for you. And some people, I think it was like another show, they play out of Memphis. And I asked, you know, I went to their Facebook group page and I said, hey, you guys got the RSS feed? And he gave me the feed to their live channel on their website, which was, you know, not what I asked for, but mm-hmm. it's like, yeah, I guess you're getting kind of close. And after a lot of digging, I finally found it. It's like, okay, yeah. This is what I was looking for. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of active work and digging sometimes, right?
Yes. So how did you decide to get into podcasting from an artist's point of view?
Well, I would go to these Paracons, and I would go to I broadcast my first show in September of last year. So I've been doing this for quite a while, not a year yet, but I've been doing it for a good while. I had previous podcasting experience through a video game website called Original Gamer. He had a video game commentary type of show, and he would bring me in as talent to be, I guess, his color commentary, you know, the guy who would just come in that he could bounce off of and, you know, sort of spice things up a bit. Mm-hmm. And then another friend of mine, Ed Solis, he had a YouTube channel called ConTalk that was a review of conventions. And after Original Gamer had done, you know, their things and it had wrapped itself up and moved on to other things, you know, I continued podcasting with him. And I had originally, you know, said, hey, why don't you and me do a different podcast? Because oftentimes during the convention stuff, like every now and then I want to bring up a hot topic or something or something related to the fandom. And he would, you know, as far as like comic books, geeks, nerds, Star Trek, Star Wars and stuff like that, I'd want to bring up a topic, an upcoming topic or something. And he was like, no, this is just strictly convention things. We're just talking about conventions. And the only times we would talk about hot topics is if it was brought up during a panel review or something like that. So it gave me the idea like, well, you know, I got to kind of do this on my own. And one, you know, learning to do stuff on my own is something I've kind of always gotten used to. Because one of the things is, as an independent, you know, comic book artist, you know, I don't just do the art. I pretty much published comic books by myself from scratch because I've had to learn how to do that because I can't get, you know, it's not that I can't get help. I could get help. It's just sometimes help costs money.
Yes.
And I'm extremely frugal.
Glad to know I'm not the only one.
Yes. Yeah. So anywhere I can save a dime, it's like, you know, I can pay someone to do this or I could just learn how to do it myself. And so that's what I did. And I took that with the podcasting approach. The original gamer, Oscar Gonzalez, he sold me his old podcasting equipment. So I bought that off from him because he had moved on to other things, like I said. And I used his old equipment. Ed Solis would come in every now and then, and he would help me out if I ever had a problem. And I did a few shows with him. And I, since then, I've had it going on my own so far, and so far, so good.
Huh.
It's just whenever I go to these conventions, because one of the legs of my show is not just fandom and the hot topics, but also paranormal. I would go to these events, and I think this stemmed from when I, every now and then, I would always run into Ken Gearhart because he's local San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
And me and him were constantly bumping into each other at conventions and events and stuff. And he always, every single time I see him, I'll buy a book or something.
That's where I did my Christmas shopping last year. I bought all of his books.
Yeah, yeah. We got to tell him, like, hey, Ken, you got to write more books. I need more stuff to buy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And me and him, I think one time we would talk, and we would just talk and talk for like 30 minutes. One time we went for like 45 minutes about, and I was talking to him about the nature of research and cryptozoology and all this stuff. And I was thinking, you know, me and him were having an interesting conversation. And I thought, I really need to get this on air. I really need to, if I could only record this or, cause I meet fascinating people all the time. I know fascinating people and I have fascinating conversations with them or what I think are fascinating conversations. And every now and then, you know, yeah, I would love to have my own little, you know, my own little version of The View where I take a hot topic and, you know, blah, 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 and I get to cackle like a hen or something like everyone else does. And so with that, I said, you know what? Let me just get my own show. Let me get my own show, my own paranormal show, and do this various thing with here. And it's been I've learned a lot of I've grown a lot. It's been a very fun, expanding. It's just a great experience, as you should know yourself.
Oh yeah,
what I've heard of your shows as well.
Who would you say is your target audience?
Hmm. Well, my target audiences are people who are into paranormal stuff because my show is a three-pronged attack. I have multiple audiences. I understand that not every single show is going to be for every single person. And I try to preface this first, you know, because whenever I do a show, I'll introduce it, say, hey, this is going to be a paranormal show, or hey, this is going to be a hot topic show, or hey, this is going to be a fandom show. We're going to discuss fandom stuff. And I understand that not everyone is going to listen to every single show. So my target audiences are the people like myself who, you know, pick and choose and cherry pick what they like to listen to. Because there will be times where I'll, like, what I'm counting on is people coming to my show, coming to the party late. I know that when I'm starting out, I don't expect anybody to be with me from the beginning. I just, it's foolish to expect that. No one's gonna listen to my stuff from the very beginning. But if they listen to a show that they like, I do think that they will go into the back catalog. And I want to have a various library of shows and archive that they can dive into and find what they like and find topics that they feel, you know, close to. Like if someone who is into paranormal, you know, listens to one of my paranormal shows and says, I want to hear more paranormal shows, then they can go through my catalog and find, you know, oh, I'll pick this show and this show and this show. And if they're feeling a little raunchy, you know, let me try a hot topic show. Or if it's like, oh, I saw this movie, let me try a fandom show. They can pick and choose what they like. So I understand that I'm going to have varying degrees of audiences. And my show is because, again, I have some shows, especially the hot topic shows, have lots of foul language and cussing and stuff like that that is peppered in mostly for dark humor and dark humor purposes. And those shows are, you know, with like a very, should I say, it's if you got a, like a dark sense of humor.
Kind of like the movie Bringing Out the Dead.
Yeah. It's very dark. And, you know, and there are some shows that I listen to that I enjoy that are very dark as well. And I understand that people who listen to that are going to be interested in what I have to offer as well. And if people aren't interested into that, they're free to skip that show. They don't have to listen to that specific show. Like I said, I'll let them know ahead of time that, hey, this is, you know, this is a hot topic. So expect things to get, you know, a little wild here. But when I do my paranormal stuff, yeah, I'll have a little bit of cussing in it, but only when I feel it's absolutely necessary. If you listen to, like I said, the Greg Lawson and Crypto Hulk interviews, you know, maybe there's like one or two cuss words that myself or the guests will put out. And that's like the only times that we use foul language. And then the rest of the show is just us, you know, just having a great conversation and above all, staying on topic. You know, I really don't try to take, like if I have a paranormal guest, I don't try to take him into hot topics, not all the time, maybe a little bit, but I try to keep it within the realm.
Mm-hmm. Getting on to other things. Bigfoot is probably the best known cryptid in the United States. Nessie, of course, is throughout the world, but here in the States, we've got Bigfoot. Did you ever get a chance to look into or to a show about the Bigfoot reports from San Antonio?
No, I can't say that I have. It's not something that I've really gotten into. Well, because, unfortunately, we did have a major Bigfoot hoopla, and it was done by a serial hoaxer who's infamous for hoaxing. And it's not that, you know, I'm not saying that there isn't a story there, but it's something that just doesn't interest me. I'm sure that I could probably do a show highlighting it or discussing it. you know, and if anything, it'll probably be like my Hot Topic shows where I just take it and make fun of it and have, you know, and use it for just, you know, as far as comedy content. But as far as Bigfoot sightings in San Antonio, I know that there are a few. I think there was one that was near the SeaWorld area. I don't know if that's the what I refer to as the Starbucks Bigfoot incident, where someone had alleged that, again, this is the hoaxer, had alleged that he had shot a Bigfoot. And then I cracked a joke that the bullet hit the Bigfoot so hard, it turned the Bigfoot into cardboard, mm-hmm. into cardboard and foam. It's like, what kind of bullets did you use?
The incident that was out by SeaWorld was November 30th, 2009. A woman who was staying in a tent, they call her a homeless woman, calls 911. And if you listen to it, you can call it up on YouTube. It's just the woman calls 911 to report Bigfoot. And the sound of her voice, she does not sound like she's hoaxing. And the thing is, the creature picked up a dead deer, just yanked it up off the ground with one hand and walked off with it. And that would be quite an accomplishment for anybody to hoax. Even if it was a small deer, you know, we're talking 100 pounds, how can a person possibly pick that up with one hand and walk off with it? The police did respond. They looked the area over. And then the next day, Ken and his partner went out and had a look. But it had rained throughout the night, and so they weren't able to find any tracks. But they did find the campsite, and apparently this woman and her husband had simply abandoned it. They decided they'd had enough entertainment for the night, and they just walked off and left half of what they owned.
I remember that incident. I remember Ken Gerhart going into it in detail. That was actually part of his lecture when I met him for the first time at a paranormal event thrown in downtown San Antonio. Now I remember him going into greater detail on that event. And I actually saw the photos that he presented from the site. I know exactly what you're talking about now. I just needed to jar my memory. But yeah, that as far as looking further into that, I unfortunately have not. As much as popular as Bigfoot is, I really don't quite dig too much into Bigfoot. Because I kind of feel like other cryptids out there kind of need the attention. Although on the on my Crypto Hulk interview, me and him do go back and forth, and there are a couple times where we lock horns on the various Bigfoot hypothesis. We probably go back and forth on the various theories and the possibilities of a large, you know, bipedal lost ape. And where we lock horns is just, you know, detailing with the specifics, like as far as Bigfoot's abilities and probably why and how they haven't been detected as far as they have. And I definitely recommend that show if you want to get into more on, you know, on me and Crypto Hulk discussing the Bigfoot hypothesis and evidence so far. I highly recommend that one.
I'll have to look it up.
Mm-hmm.
You said you were into abduction stories. Could you tell the listeners about this?
Yeah, in my last, it was actually a funny thing on the last show. Me and my Hot Topic guy, we had reviewed the Stan Romanek story. And I had said, just a quip, I put, yeah, I'm an abduction enthusiast. And he laughed and said, what? You're a what? And I had to explain, no, an alien abduction enthusiast, dang it. And that was a bit of a funny thing. But yeah, the alien abduction phenomenon is something that I find so intriguing. It's right up there with like some of my most favorite stuff that I love to get into. You know, stuff like Dogman, Shadow People, Black Eyed Kids, another phenomenon, what is it? Okay, it'll come to me later. But it's one of my top things is the alien abduction phenomena. I haven't been able to do much digging in the show, like presenting as far as the show goes, because I really want to interview and talk to contactees and experiencers. Now, my personal opinion on it, it's one of those where, you know, I really don't know what it is. As far as critiquing the experience, I have my own theories as to what it could be, and I come at it from a somewhat skeptical point of view. A large number of the abduction phenomenon appear, from what I can gather from the evidence that I've examined as far as people's accounts and people's stories, is I believe it's somewhere across between sleep paralysis episodes and lucid dreamings, or you know, either lucid dreaming or mixed in with a sleep paralysis episode. Now, I think that accounts for some contactee experience, but not all. And I've noticed a trend in the contactee experiences, what I like to call the gray gentrification, where before, during the 60s, if you look back in the abduction phenomenon in the 60s, we had a lot of varying entities that would abduct people. Mm-hmm. And we even had robots, which I thought was the coolest thing ever, was, you know, robots abducting people. And I thought, hey, that's really freaking awesome. And now I noticed we don't have robots anymore. Of course, some people would say, well, the robots are the grays now. And another thing I've noticed about the abduction phenomena, again, is that the as far as how the aliens gain entry is improving and evolving. Because before, you know, either they would catch you out on the road, they would land their little spacecraft, and they would chase you down, you know, stop your car, pull you out of your car, or they would walk into your home through your front door, through your window. And then it got to the point to where they were just walking through the walls themselves, opening the portals through people's walls. And I'm thinking, well, if they can just open portals through walls, do they even need craft anymore? It's like, well, what's the point of craft anymore? And it's this sort of this evolving phenomenon. And I'm thinking, so either the aliens are evolving, or how we interpret them is evolving. It's like, are they changing, or are we, or how we seeing them change is changing. And I just, it's one of those things where I don't want to say like I have a definitive answer, but it's something where I want to hear more. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as far as a conclusion, I have no hypothesis whatsoever. I'm still in the stages of let me just gather all the information I can, because I want to hear these stories. I love, you know, hearing about all these different races and stuff. You know, I'm kind of tired of the grays myself, but, you know, I'll take them if they're there. But as far as all these different encounters that people have, you know, I mean, as a skeptic, yeah, I listen to the stories. And again, as I admit to being a skeptic, I'm not a cynic, as I hear how Micah Hanks likes to make that distinction when he does. I'm a hopeful skeptic, as in I try to remain open-minded, but I want to get as much evidence as I can and look at what the proof that we have out there and say, you know, well, you know, as far as people's experiences, I can't really, you know, say you didn't have that or it was just sleep paralysis, unless the evidence suggests that, you know, that it could be a possibility. Like I'm saying, yeah, it could be a possibility that such and such was a sleep paralysis episode. And but I'm not saying for definitive, like, hey, that is absolutely what it was, because as far as people's experiences, that's their experience, that's their interpretation. You know, I didn't have the experience, so I can't say for absolute certainty that, you know, grays came through the wall or that Bigfoot ran off with the deer carcass. I wasn't there. Mm-hmm. I didn't see it. And if I have my own experience, which I hope I don't because I hear they're pretty wild, then, you know, I would probably be in that same boat as well. And that's why I got to give a lot of credit to Travis Walton, because he knows that as far as credibility goes, what he can prove. And he's presented his evidence so far, and he doesn't try to force any kind of hypothesis on us. He'll state like, yeah, I have my own opinion about how my encounter played out, but I know what I can prove. And what I like about the Travis Walton case is that his story has maintained consistency. The people involved have maintained consistency. I know he and other protractors of his account like to bring up that, well, the lie detector test, the what do they call them, polygraph tests?
Yes, polygraph.
Yeah, the polygraph tests have, you know, I can understand at the time those were staples of credibility, but in this modern age, we don't even use polygraph tests anymore because they're just not that admissible as evidence in court, because they just register reactions. They don't really tell whether or not a person is lying. It just says, is this person nervous under questioning? But I think what is the greater story is his consistency and the consistency of the seven other people, of the other witnesses. And I think that, especially after 30 years, I think speaks more to the credibility, or at least definitely is something worth noting more so than I think any polygraph test could.
I kind of remember when the incident happened. I would have been about 17 or 18 years old. And you're right, from the first time I heard the story up until I listened to Travis Walton talking on my show a couple of weeks ago, he's telling the exact same story. He's not embellishing it. He's not trying to make it sound just a little better. It's the same story. So
yes,
it does add a whole lot of credibility to his incident, shall we say.
Yeah, and it's a remarkable experience. I'm sure he's had more experiences, but he's not going to come forward with them because, again, it's because, like, unless he can prove them, because he knows, like the rest of us, like anyone else, you know, you can have a claim, but, you know, what can you prove? I understand that there's a difference between proof and evidence. Evidence is, you know, someone like, I saw a Bigfoot, let me write it down, let me report it. That is evidence that someone saw a Bigfoot. You know, someone found a footprint. Okay, that's evidence of a Bigfoot. That is not proof of a Bigfoot. It doesn't prove that Bigfoot is real. It doesn't prove that Bigfoot exists. It just proves anything that people saw something, people experienced something. You know, proof is a body. Proof is, you know, definitive, something that is indisputable. Like I would say the closest thing that we have to proof is the Patterson-Gimlin film in the Bigfoot phenomena, which is, you know, it has stayed up to scrutiny. I know there are some people who like, oh, it's just a man in an ape suit. And I'd have to say, you know, like, people have tried to recreate that with, the 70s or 60s technology, and it just hasn't been able to be done, like, especially with the technology at the time. You know, and from when I've heard, it explained, like, from, I guess, what would be more learned people, you know, I am compelled to believe that it does have some credibility to it.
If Roger Patterson had built this suit, and then if he had paid somebody a god-awful amount of money to walk through the woods so that him and Bob Gimlin could film it, he wasted his life looking for Bigfoot. Roger should have ran off to Hollywood and said, look what I just made. He'd have been making millions of dollars from that point on, because Hollywood couldn't do a suit like that back then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and people have tried to recreate it, you know, even to this day, and it hasn't come back convincing, or at least not up to that level that he had. And you have to remember back in the 1976, was it?
75, I believe. I'm not going to swear to it. I'd have to look at my notes. In the 70s. It was a long time ago.
Yeah, a long time. During the good old days. We'll just say that. During the good old days, things like advanced prosthetics and latex and stuff, they simply weren't available in the industry at the time. And, you know, especially in the Hollywood industry, you know, the people who it's their job to make this sort of thing and to make it believable. I think it was years later that latex masks were able to be mass produced by the special effects wizards. But at the time, I don't think they had that technology available to them. But as far as, you know, because I think they said something about the placement of the shoulders mm-hmm. or something like that and how they swung in relation to the torso. That putting someone in a suit and, you know, that would not have worked out.
Also, the elbows were too far down for a human. I just looked it up. It was 1967.
Okay.
We were close, but I hate to think what the world would be like today if every time someone had a question, they had to run to the bookshelf, pull a book down, and look the subject up as opposed to just putting it on the computer and asking the question. The bad thing about using the computer, though, is there is so much information out there that is wrong, and it's having to wade through these feet and yards of nonsense trying to find what's the truth as opposed to what did somebody just manufacture and throw out there.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I believe I think I spoke about this with Ken in private, was about how we have all this information. We have libraries of information. We have archives of information. But what we don't have is critical thinking. We don't have people being critical and researching. We don't have people like – they're not teaching research. They're not teaching civil discourse. They're not teaching, you know, how to make and present an argument, how to cross-reference sources, and how to, you know, say, you know, hey, this is wrong. It's not just saying, oh, this is wrong because, you know, I believe it's wrong. It's like, this is wrong. Let me show you evidence contrary to it. Let me prove, you know, let me make a compelling case and present my evidence that why, you know, such and such is not so. You know, we've lost that, unfortunately. And now we've gotten to the point where, you know, we can't even, like, especially on Facebook and in one of the UFO groups that I'm a part of, that we have discussions, the moderator, poor guy, he has to kick people out every now and then because people just cannot behave themselves discussing topics. It's like, we're talking about UFOs. You don't need to bring in personal attacks and very wild cussing language. You don't have to lose your mind because someone disagrees with you over a fuzzy photograph that is completely unnecessary. And we don't need that in the community. And unfortunately, that's becoming a part of our community because it's just, I think the technology is growing faster than our ability to harness it properly, because we still have those primitive reptilian brains. We get something shiny and new, and, you know, we have it instead of using it, you know, like it's supposed to be, like it should be used. Instead, we just try to bash each other over the head with it. Yeah.
You said something about a good Travis Walton story.
Oh, yeah. This is, it's sort of, it's a good story, but at the same time, it's kind of, it's a bit tragic in the same sense. You remember where I had talked about where I had interviewed Crypto Hulk, right?
Yes.
Well, during the interview, I had asked him, you know, what he was doing during the Hurricane Harvey, and he discussed his experiences. Well, while he was doing that, I was off hanging out with Travis Walton. And what it was is there was a September, I believe it was 16th or 17th, it was Paracon in Houston. I had gone down to Houston to go to the Paracon there, and they had one of the guest speakers was Travis Walton, and another one was the guy, one of the producers of Ancient Aliens, and Greg Lawson was there as well. And I was figured I'll go there for one day and I'll just go and I'll have fun. And you know, and while I'm there, I run into Greg Lawson in the lobby. And of course, me and him make plans to go drinking afterwards. And I'm thinking, you know, I really want to meet Travis Walton. I really want to meet him, say hello, buy a book, and get a picture. You know, I don't care what it costs. He's worth it. Mm-hmm. I have never met him before. On the way there, I listened to last podcast on the left. It's another podcast, and they had done the Travis Walton story. And they had done a very, very in-depth analysis of his account, as well as the aftermath of the account and all the stuff that was going on while he was, you know, under duress of the extraterrestrial visitors. And so I had all that knowledge fresh in my head, and I had gone down there, and I thought, you know, okay, I'm going to maybe get, you know, if I'm lucky, 2 minutes to talk to him, because I expect him to be swamped. Well, unfortunately, what the Hurricane Harvey had done is it had severely displaced a lot of people. The convention itself, they were wondering, you know, like, are we even going to have the show on or not? Because, you know, all this, as much as the whole city around them had pretty much been underwater. And luckily, the hotel was on high ground, so they didn't suffer any damages. However, it severely impacted their attendance because a lot of people that were planning on going just couldn't make it because either they were local Houston people and they had something else. They had the hurricane aftermath to deal with, or they were coming in and they were like, well, there's a lot of severe damage down there. I don't know if it would be safe for me to go down there. Well, I braved my way down there and I drove down there, and as I was driving, when I get to the hotel, I drove through one of the neighborhoods, and I could see the water line along the houses, and all these houses were gutted, as in, you know, they looked great and pristine on the outside, but in everyone's lawn was all of the refuge of the stuff that they had to pull out of their houses, and it was very, very tragic. And then I finally get to the hotel, I finally check in, and the hotel, It's as far as attendance is going, I say it was very low attendance, unfortunately. And a lot of people who were staying in the hotel were people who were displaced by the hurricane. So I walk up, you know, to Travis Walton, and, you know, I figure, you know, I'm not going to be a creepy guy and hound him or anything. I'm just going to go talk to him for 5 minutes and then be on my way. Well, I go up there, I talk to him for 5 minutes, you know, and we go back and forth a little bit. I crack a Philip Glass joke and instantly get on his good side, which is the easiest way because I knew, you know, I knew the story. So I crack the Philip Glass joke and he gets a chuckle out of it. And, you know, and we're best buddies, like, all of a sudden. So for like 5 minutes, you know, we're talking back and forth, and he's a very sensible like myself, he's a critical thinker, and he, you know, common sense guy, and you know, we go on and on, and then I'm like, okay, it's been 5 minutes, you know, I don't want to, I can't keep, it would be wrong for me to try to keep him to myself. So then I was like, you know, hey, I'll see you around, okay? So I walk off, and I walk to my friend Greg Lawson's table, and me and him chit-chat for a little bit. And apparently he's in the same room as Travis Walton is. And, you know, as much as I hate to say it, you know, because of the attendance hit from the hurricane, you know, like maybe one or two other people were going to his table. So then I figured, okay, he looks bored. I'll go talk to him for a little bit. Like, I'm going to go talk to Travis Walton. And then I go and we talk for like 30 more minutes. And it's, as far as, you know, because, you know, I've heard this on other shows, it's like everybody, you know, wants a piece of Travis Walton, you know, because he is such a great guy, and he's a very nice man and a very gracious man. Mm-hmm. And I'm just sitting there, and I'm just having the time of my life talking to this guy for such a long time. And we're talking about more than just, you know, we're not just talking aliens. We're talking, you know, critical thinking. We're talking common sense stuff. We're talking hot topics. We're talking politics. You know, we're just, I feel like I've known this guy forever, and we're just, you know, talk going on and on and on. And then, you know, and then it's like, you know, okay, I'm taking too much of your time. I'll talk to you later. So I buy a bunch of his stuff, and he gives me, you know, one of his CDs, you know, for free, you know, mm-hmm. It's like, you really didn't have to do that, but thank you so much. And then, at the there was a VIP dinner that was for special VIP people and for guests. And, you know, I, of course, you know, being savvy as I am, I managed to sneak myself into there. I didn't know if I was supposed to be there or not, but, you know, I snuck myself into the VIP dinner. And they had like a VIP, you know, brunch and VIP this, you know, for the whole day. And I'm going in there. And, you know, Travis Walton, he's there, and he waves at me, and he's like, and I get to sit next to him. Throughout the dinner, this is like a two-hour dinner, you know, that was special, you know, just for guests and special VIP attendees. And I get to have dinner with Travis Walton, and we're just sitting and chatting. You know, I got Travis Walton on one side. I got Greg Lawson on the other side. And we're just all going back and forth, having this great time. And that experience was something that, you know, I mean, it was lightning in a bottle, a synchronicity that will probably never happen ever again. So I have the time of my life, you know, and we're talking everything. We're talking comic books and stuff like that. And it's just, you know, and it is just a remarkable experience, you know. Like, he'll say something, and then when he has a conversation, you know, I'll throw in a quip, and then we'll all laugh, and it's just, it's a great experience. And it is something that, you know, that it's basically, you know, I get to have this Travis Walton experience, and it's something that I will always remember and I will always cherish. And because of that, you know, it's like I don't feel the need to hound him for an interview, because I got, in a sense, I got a piece of him. Mm. I got his time. I got his undivided attention for dinner. I got to have dinner with Travis Walton. And it was such a mind-blowing experience that, you know, I mean, as much as I would love to interview him, I don't, it doesn't feel right to me, because I had this experience that it completely sated me. It was such a satisfying experience that I really don't feel like I need anything more of him. Like, I don't want to ask anything more of him, because he had, in that night, had given me so much, especially of his time and his attention. And I pretty much got to be the, you know, the ultimate fanboy for one day. And I walked away from that. You know, I walked away from it like it would be hokey for me to say, yeah, I walked away from it transformed. But that is something that most people would dream of, that the average person, be they a contactee, fan or not, they're not going to get that. And I will always cherish that experience. And that was just the time of my life. And at that time, I had like one episode under my belt, and it was where I was just talking about my own paranormal experiences, and that's all that I had. And it was just a remarkable. So that's when I was like, I think I had started podcasting the week before, and it reinvigorated me as far as, you know, sharing these experiences with people that I want to take that and I want to share it with people. And as far as, you know, that experience, you know, that was my own personal experience, and I love it so much. And, you know, like, that's probably why you'll never hear Travis Walton on my show, because I don't need to ask him. I don't need anything from him like I said, I got so much in that night.
Well, me and my wife did get to eat dinner with Bob Gimlin one night, but there were 200 people in the room and half of them between us and him, but we did eat. nothing like having him all to yourself for 2 hours, though.
Yeah.
What is your take on shadow beings?
Well, I'm a bit divided. On the one hand, I believe it's part of the sleep paralysis experience. On the other hand, I've heard some people say that they're watchers who safeguard us when our bodies are out there in the ether. As of me, I really don't know, but that's why whenever I come across stories or I hear stories of people having experiences, I just buckle down and listen because I want to know more. I've had sleep paralysis experiences. I've seen like maybe a shadow out of the corner of my eye. And of course you turn and it's nothing. And for me, that's not good enough. That's completely inconclusive. And my sleep paralysis episodes were, they were kind of embarrassing. Not as far as, I wasn't, molested by a ghost or anything, but it was more like, it was just so anticlimactic. Do you want to hear my sleep paralysis thing?
Go for it.
God, this is terrible. Okay. Now, when most people have the sleep paralysis experience, you're on your back, you're on your chest, your legs and hands are sprawled out, and you will have an intruder. You will feel a presence, and you will have an intruder. For most people, this is either a gray witch, a man in a hat, some type of scary or fearsome entity. What would happen to me is my eyes would shoot open. I would be in a room and I would be in the sleep paralysis state. I would be frozen and I would have this fear come over me. And what would enter my room wouldn't be any kind of classical entity that most people, no shadow people, no grays, no witches, no mystical anything. Instead, it was people. When I say people, like humans, people, regular people, and they would come in and they would be dressed like ratty people from Walmart, just garish, ugly clothes. And they would look at me in the bed and they would go around they would go through my things and they would, rumble through my room and they would open closets that in my room that didn't exist. They would open closets, rummage through my things, and then, walk out the door and close it behind them. And then when I could gain control, again, I get up and I look around and nothing has been trifled with. I have no evidence that anyone was ever in my room or in my home. But that's my experience. And I think it's happened to me twice where I've had, as I could best describe it, white trash. That's what my entities are. I have white trash entities coming, going through my things. And that's just the sum of my sleep paralysis experiences. And I guess what spoiled it for me was I knew what sleep paralysis was before I had the experience because I had done tons of research. And when it was coming, it's like, okay, I know what's happening. I'm feeling this fear. I feel scared, but I would actually will myself out of the episode of the sleep paralysis. I would will myself out of its hold on me. And I've been able to battle it, but as far as, when I have the visitations, it's disappointing.
So you're being haunted by the people of Walmart.
Unfortunately.
That is original.
I told you it was disappointing and embarrassing.
That's almost as disappointing as the time my wife and I ran into a ghost.
Oh, God. Let me hear it.
If she hadn't have been there, I'd have convinced myself that I was mistaken. We're going into the new Mercy Hospital, not to be mistaken for the old one, which is definitely haunted. And the new Mercy, there's two banks of elevators, and they face each other across the corridor. We come around the corridor. We're going to get on an elevator and go up to the third or fourth floor. And as we are walking towards the elevator, a man comes rushing from the other end of the corridor, steps onto an elevator, and the doors close. And I knew that if I pushed the button immediately, the doors would open, and he'd probably be upset because I'd interrupted his journey. So I waited a couple of seconds, just standing there talking to my wife. Then, when I was convinced that the elevator was on its way, I pushed the button to call for the next elevator. The same set of doors open. I started to stick my head in, and I looked around, and the elevator was empty. So, my first thought is, okay, I was mistaken. But then my wife said, we're sorry, we didn't mean to. And I noticed she's looking around the elevator. So we both get on. I pushed the floor button that we needed to go to. And then I asked her, describe to me exactly what you saw. And she described the following, not in the same detail because she was never in law enforcement. Guy had dark hair. Well-groomed, he was combed, he was shaven, no mustache, no glasses. He had on a white shirt with long sleeves, and the sleeves were each rolled up, two turns at the cuffs. He had on black dress pants with a black shiny belt, and he had on black patent leather shoes. He was medium height. He was just a little bit shorter than I was, and that was exactly what I had seen. And we looked at each other, and it's like, there is no way the guy could have gotten out of the elevator because the excess hatch is too high off the floor. You'd need a ladder. The only thing we could come up with was that had to have been a ghost. But it was about the most disappointing ghost I'd ever seen in my life. I was always expecting them to look like something from Hollywood where you could see through them and they would like shimmer across the floor without touching it. And it turns out that this guy looked like just anybody else. Totally disappointing. Go ahead.
Are you sure it was a ghost or some guy jumping through time or something?
I would say it was a ghost simply because of the situation we were in, a hospital. If you listen to Expanded Perspectives, that's a podcast out of Weatherford, Texas. Really good. They're listened to all over the planet. Cam Hale and... Okay. I've forgotten his name completely. Cam Hale and Filson. Anyway, these two guys, they were telling about incidences from a hospital where a woman had seen the exact same thing that we had, except her ghost was an older lady who was wearing the pink and white striped dress that they used to wear, the candy stripers. Same thing happened. A woman gets on the elevator. The doors close. The woman pushes the button. The doors open, and the woman was gone. Same story. Oh, Kyle Filson. And the similarity between the two was so much, I played the show for my wife, and she was like, that's exactly what happened to us. But it looked so much like a regular human person that, like I said, it was complete disappointment.
Yeah. It's like we hear about everyone else's experiences, and they're oftentimes fantastical, in some cases too fantastical. And then when it really happens, it's like, wait, what?
Yeah, we have a ghost incident down at the local college, Laredo Community College. And it's a white lady. She drifts across the road. Her feet are like about 6 inches off the ground. It looks like a ghost. You can see things through her body. And I've heard this story from several different people. Now that's a ghost. Yeah. What I saw was disappointing.
Yeah. I don't know what it is about colleges. Ghosts seem to love colleges, because I remember the audio video department of Amarillo College when I used to go there for community college. Their studio was haunted.
Hmm.
I've heard ghost stories of there from the techs that worked there.
Well, LCC used to be a military fort back before the Civil War.
Hmm.
Changing,
so that could probably account for that one, yeah.
Changing the subject just a little bit. You are into comics, it would seem.
Absolutely.
I see you do artwork. How did you get started in comics?
How did I get started? Like,
why did you go towards the comic book as opposed to just a regular novel without pictures?
Well, I'm mostly a self-taught artist. I do have classical training from community colleges and, you know, like refined art classes. But I would have to say it's like most of my stuff is self-taught, because let's be honest, most community college at the time I went to them, they don't teach you how to draw comic books.
Mm-hmm.
They don't teach you how to draw cartoons. They teach you how to draw bowls of fruit and cow skulls, because that's what we draw in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone else gets bowls of fruit and seashells. We get cow skulls. But as far as, you know, pushing myself into comic book art, whenever my first doodle was when I was bored. I was 12 years old. My dad was barbecuing, and I was just bored as heck. And I was like, and I had a little spiral paper and a pencil. I was like, Dad, I guess I'll draw something. What should I draw? And he's like, just draw the dog. Yeah. So I drew a picture of the dog, and it was a really good picture of the dog. So then I said, this is fun. I guess I'll draw more of the dog. So I drew more pictures of my dog. And I would, you know, I figured just drawing him, the dog, wasn't enough. It wasn't satisfying. So I would put little stories. I would have little stories where he would have space adventures. He would have adventures in space. He then evolved into a little character I called Dog Tracy, because at the time, the Warren Beatty Dick Tracy movie came out, and that Dick Tracy, that gumshoe noir, it infected me hard. It got into my brain, and I couldn't get enough of it. So my dog was now a detective, and he was going on adventures and solving crimes and fighting bad guys and doing superhero stuff. And from then on, that just evolved, and I just, you know, I do commission artwork. I do draw people's characters. People come up to me and they'll say, you know, draw, you know, can you draw my D&D character, or can you draw my Transformers character, or something like this. You know, some people come at me with their original characters, which I love. I love drawing original characters, you know, breathing life into someone's original creation. And I do enjoy, you know, making my own original creations. But whenever I draw, sometimes, you know, I get the urge, I have to tell a story. Something has to be happening. There has to be meaning behind it. I got nothing against, you know, regular fan art and pinups and stuff like that. That's good and it's fun. But, you know, I need a story every now and then. Every now and then there has to be a point to something. There has to be either a joke, a punchline, an adventure, a mystery, something like that. And that drew me into doing comic books. And I would, you know, be part of art groups in my younger years. We would then get into, you know, we would get together. We would, you know, we would publish our own comic books at one time. There was a comic book group that I had formed with numerous friends called First Storm Manga. And we would create our own fanzines, and we would publish them. We would self-publish everything, and we did everything ourselves. And from then on, I took that experience, and then I eventually published my own comic books, you know, self-published comic books. I would go to conventions. I would sell them. One of my first independents was a steampunk comic book called Steam Pets. It was a it's a, like a sort of a post-apocalyptic type of adventure with dogs dressed up in steampunk outfits and stuff like this. And I would take this to, and this was during the honestly the mid to late 2000s. And I would, that's when steampunk was really, really super big. And I would take this to all the steampunk conventions, and I would sell maybe one or two copies. Hmm. And it was just either, and usually my friends would buy them out of sympathy. But then I would take it to a comic book convention or an anime convention, and I would sell out completely. Which was funny because I made this thing, I made it specifically for a steampunk audience. And I made it G-rated, so again, anyone could pick it up. So I figured, oh, the steampunks will love this because I'm a steampunk, and you know, these are my people, and they stayed away from it. I never got it. They just didn't want to pick it up, but everyone else everywhere is like, oh, this is cool. This is steampunk. I love this. You know, any place where they're not steampunks, I would sell out. And then, of course, people would come up to me and they would tell me their stories about, oh, I used to be a steampunk. And then I'm like, what happened? And then they're like, well, I wasn't steampunk enough for these people. And then they would tell me stories about how, you know, the steampunk crowd would be mean to them and stuff. And I would hear this story over and over again. And let's just say, you know, I'm still involved in the steampunk fandom, but not as involved as I once was. I don't let it get to my head anymore, but it was a fun adventure when it lasted, and I learned so much from it, and it was a great experience.
Why do you think steampunk community was so hard on people?
I think it's a sort of it's one of those you – everyone prides themselves on their steampunk outfits. And what happens is we form cliques, and then cliques turn into like exclusive things, and the communities, they get tighter, and everyone, you know, they start, I guess this process happens that I call people getting lost in their monsters. We all sort of create our own monster, and these people get lost in it, unfortunately. Hmm. There's just so much infighting in the community, and it's just – and the thing is the thing with steampunk community that is different from, say, Star Trek or Star Wars is there is no source material. With Star Trek, you know, everyone is they're dressing up to play out a movie. They're dressing up to play out an official comic book adaption. They're dressing up to play out a video game adaption. There's some official source that they draw inspiration from. Steampunk is a concept. There is no original source. People are drawing from an idea. And because there are so many different varying ideas, we get into a lot of what I guess is just, I guess, spitting contests where people are like, you know, oh, you're not as good as me because you're not as extravagant as me. And this sort of elitism happens, and gatekeepers, you know, it's like people can't feel like they're on top unless someone is beneath them. Mm. Unfortunately, it's really tragic. And yeah, I mean, on the surface, you go up to like a steampunk, and I'm pretty sure they'll be nice to you most of the time. It's just here, most of the people who are nicest to regular people in the steampunk community are vendors, because they're trying to make money off people. So, of course, they have to be nice, open, and inviting. And oftentimes, you know, presenters and spokespeople, because they want followers, and they need followers and members and stuff like that. Steampunks themselves, who are all dressed up, you know, they're usually not nice to ordinary people, because if you're not as dressed up as extravagant as they are, then you're not on the same level as they are. You're not into it as much as they are. So they have no reason to talk to you. And oftentimes people there in character. And the sad thing is no one knows what the heck their character is outside of them. So everyone, as far as their character, is all the same. It's like, I'm this snooty aristocrat sky captain esquire, and people don't know how to approach that. You know, it's kind of intimidating when you walk up to a guy and he's got his head in the nose and his head is in the cloud and his nose is just staring up and he's speaking in a phony British accent. That's not approachable. Mm-hmm. So when people come up to me, and I do dress steampunked up, but I don't radiate the sophisticated, snobby attitude. So people approach me. They approach me. They talk to me. They tell me what they love about it. And I agree. And it's like, yes, it is. This is a great, wonderful thing. And then they talk to another steampunk, and then the steampunk just gives them a snooty attitude. And then, you know, it's like they'll only speak to regular people unless either you're asking to take their picture or you're complimenting them. And, you know, and then I never see that other person again. And it just, it bothers me.
I can imagine.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, being a provocative personality myself, I think I was excommunicated from the steampunk community 3 times.
Are your comic books out in stores anywhere?
Unfortunately, no. I would sell everything out of the back of a truck. If people want to purchase a comic book, all they have to do is just go on a Facebook, look up Steam Pets. It is available on Facebook. You can contact me there and purchase a copy if you like. I have several copies available. I think it was original five-year run, I probably sold, you know, out the back of my, I like to say out the back of my truck, I probably sold maybe 500 copies of Steam Pets, and like maybe 100 I gave away to friends. So it, as far as a small independent press, you know, just going to conventions wherever I can set up, that sounds pretty good.
That's kind of how I do my books. It's just you can get them in the bookstore, but you got to order them. Yeah. Unfortunately, that's the drawback of being your own publisher. you don't have the connections with the bookstores hardly.
Yeah. It's changing a bit. I did an independent publishing show with Eduardo Solis, and me and him went through the long, boring details of self-publishing and how to get it, you know, as far as, you know, dealing with the ISBN, putting it on, you know, the Crook, putting it on, the Nook, putting it on the Nook, going through Barnes & Nobles, going through Amazon, going through all these different things. And he says it's a lot easier now. But a few years ago, it was quite a chore. So if you've been, you tell me you have like, what, up to 20 plus titles?
Yes.
Yeah, I imagine you've probably, though those few early ones must have been a real chore. And hopefully it's getting a lot easier now.
Some of it is that they've still got a few kinks they need to work out, I believe. They keep updating the website, and every time they update the website, it loses about half the people that use it. It's like, I'm not an IT guy. Stop changing this program because, well, that's the problem with IT and politicians. If they're not changing something just to be changing it, they don't really have a job.
Yeah. Yeah, that always happens when someone new enters the office. The only way to look like they're busy is to change everything and inconvenience everyone.
Do you have any upcoming conventions where you'll be advertising or offering your books?
I don't have anything planned as of yet, as of this moment, unfortunately. But in the future, I do plan on taking Conspire Theory on the road. I do plan on setting up booths at conventions and just showcasing the show, showcasing my comic books, and just being out there again. I'm sort of in a, like, what I guess I could call a reconstruction year right now. Mm. I'm just getting the podcast started out. I have a few other projects that I'm going to be working on, and this is basically a build up. But now that the Conspire Theory show is starting to grow and I'm starting to gain some momentum on that, you know, I feel more confident putting it out there, and I look forward to taking it to events that, you know, because I love going to paranormal events and I love having fun there. But one of the things that I learned being an artist at art shows and stuff is it's very hard to teach myself to go to a show and just have fun. That's very, very hard for me because I'm so conditioned to running a table. Mm-hmm. So it's like I'm so used to just like, I gotta set up a table or at some conventions I'm actually on the staff. So it's like, oh, I gotta run this, I gotta run this room, I gotta run this panel, I gotta, you know, it's very, I'm just learning now to just go to a show, relax, and have fun. And so I'm not in a rush to put myself in the mix of manning a table, mm-hmm. but I do look forward to doing it with Conspire Theory.
Well, fantastic. So wish you all the luck with your podcast. Hope it is a raging success. Do you still do any of the comics, or is that you're kind of on hold with the artwork?
I'm still taking commission work, and I still do commission work. I have several, you know, projects in the pipeline that I can release more details on. When I get more stuff, more concrete stuff together, I'll definitely hit you up because I'll need to promote it.
Alrighty.
And you'll hear about it. You'll definitely hear about it. And the same for you. If you have a new book coming out that you think you would love to talk about on my show, I would love to have you come and plug your books and talk about some of your stuff later on down the line.
We'll have to set a date on our calendars and see if we can get that done. Well,
yes.
Before I let you go, real quick, what is your podcast? How can people find it again?
Okay, it is Conspire a Theory. You can find it on most popular podcatchers. I've submitted it to iTunes. I have not yet heard back from them, but they should be posting it soon. And you can find it, just go into, just search Conspire Theory. Or if you have any outlets such as Twitter, go find me personally, Psycho Chris, on Twitter. And I will give you the RSS feed to plug into your podcatcher, whatever pod service that you have, so that you can subscribe from it there. I am also on Instagram under Conspire a Theory. There is a link to the podcast homepage in my profile. I am on Facebook. Conspire a Theory has its own Facebook page and group, so people can go there and find it there. Trying to think.
How about Podomatic? Do you have your archives available there?
Yes, on Podomatic as well. It's good to go to Podomatic and just search for Conspire Theory as well. You can find it there. And pretty much I should be showing up on Google as far as Conspire Theory. Mm-hmm. And let's see, and there's also a Patreon. I have Conspire Theory is underneath Patreon support. So if people want to show some monetary support for the show, definitely hit me up there as well.
That's where my wife comes in. She buys most of the equipment I use for the show. She's my support group.
She's your Patreon.
Yes. Well, I appreciate you being on the show, sir. And as soon as you have something new to talk about, I'll get you back. We always know how to get a hold of each other now.
Excellent.
This is Strange Things with Chris James, speaking with Chris Holm from Conspire a Theory. Back in 1776, someone said, "Give me coffee or give me death." And if that's how you feel, you should be at the Organic Man Coffee Trek. They make coffee the right way. One delicious cup at a time. 4501 McPherson, Suite Number 9. Coffee, the stuff dreams are made of.
Are you coming to the tree where they strung up a man the same murder three? Strange things that happen here, no stranger would it be if we met at midnight in the hanging tree?